I think we're going to get started now. I really appreciate everybody who's come. And we're going to start with just kind of an overview of some of the issues that the panel's going to be discussing. For some of you are from Alaska and know these issues very well, others from elsewhere. So I wanted to sort of bring you there through some pretty amazing photography that my colleague Lauren Holmes from the Anchorage Daily News did in our reporting effort. And I'm going to just launch in now, and then we'll get right to our panelists who are holding online. So first of all, the Bering Sea. It stretches between Alaska and Russia. It's 1,500 miles across at its broadest point, to a distance of just 51 miles in the Bering Strait. Sometimes forget that just across the way is Russia. Let me make sure. It provides about 40% of the seafood through all of the U.S. I apologize here. So we've got about 40% of the entire seafood catch of the U.S. comes from Bristol Bay. And get used to this here. Last summer, there was a record return.
Can actually use the microphone.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Can people hear me better?
It's about the recording, too. Not
okay.
Just the... Thank you.
Last summer, a record return of more than 76 million sockeye salmon stormed back from Bristol Bay, from the Bering Sea to Bristol Bay. And they filled nets and the spawning grounds. And that was the biggest harvest in more than 100 years. And meanwhile, two other species of Pacific salmon we'll hear more about in the panel discussion, Chinook and Chum. They're vital to the subsistence harvest of Western Alaska's native people. And they have been in sharp decline last year, and again, it looks like this year. And this year, for the first time ever, the Alaska snow crab harvest was canceled, and the Bristol Bay red king crab, for a second year in a row, was canceled. So basically, in 2022, Seattle Times and the Anchorage Daily News partnered with the support of the Pulitzer Center to report on the snow crab decline and the record sockeye harvest and explore some of the larger questions of what rising ocean temperatures mean for the Bering Sea and the people who depend on it. I recently left the Seattle Times in March and was part of the reporting team that included Anchorage Daily News photojournalist Lauren Holmes, whose images are on display. And scientists are still struggling to unravel all the impacts of climate change and the heat wave in the Bering Sea. Some species of fish, such as pollock and cod, surged north as the waters warmed. There were large seabird die-offs, and an unusual number of gray whales died on their annual migration north to feed each summer in the Bering Strait waters of Russia. The winter ice, which contributes to the Bering Sea's extraordinary productivity, has been one focal point of the research. The ice, as it melts, helps to support algae, a cornerstone of the food chain. The meltwater forms a frigid cold pool along the bottom that offers snow crabs some protection from predators such as cod. In 2019, the winter ice amid the heat wave was almost a no-show, and the 2019 ice pack was only a modest improvement. Some climate models indicate that the Bering Sea's winter ice may be lost entirely by 2070 or 2090, depending on how fast greenhouse gases driven by fossil fuel combustion accumulate in the atmosphere. That doesn't mean that all temperatures will be steadily rising from year to year all over the world. And certainly in January of 22, as Lauren and I joined the crew of the crab boat Pinnacle for the small winter harvest, you can see the Bering Sea winter ice was making quite a comeback. Pinnacle skipper Mark Casco, he often cursed the ice for all the complications and risks it added to the winter harvest. the chill temperatures that came with making all the ice, they could also generate freezing spray that would coat the boat and gear, making the Pinnacle Bay, the Pinnacle boat top heavy and more like liable to sink. So people removed it with the aid of mallets, and then electric jackhammers were really important and used quite a bit that on our the trip. But I got to say that the ice was also a welcome sight that year, because it was a sign of a more normal winter in the Bering Sea, which might help set the stage for at least a short-term recovery of the snow crab. At least that's what everyone's hope was. And federal surveys in 2018 found a big year for snow crab, but they returned for another survey in 2021 after the marine heat wave. And really, the heat wave had peaked and the crab populations had absolutely crashed. And National Marine Fisheries Service scientists, they say there likely were some reasons that are definitely related to the warming that are responsible for the die-off. One factor might have been increased predation from cod, because the cold pool, they didn't have any problem penetrating that area where the young crab dwell. But also the higher sea temperatures increased the metabolism rates of the crab and their need for food. And so there's a lot of thinking that many just starved. And this year, even as the crabbers are sidelined, another fleet working out of Dutch Harbor largely, trawlers, you can see a trawl net there, they continue to drag the bottom and fish for their fish, such as pollock or cod, and they may kill or crush crab as they fish, and that's a source of great concern among the fishermen, the crab fishermen who don't have a harvest of snow crab or king. It took, and this is a picture of Dutch Harbor. It's a volcanic island in the Aleutians. Well, it's a port, and this is the island of Unalaska. Gives you a sense of the place. Well, it took Casto and the Pinnacle crew. We were on board the boat for about 2 weeks to catch their small 2022 quota, which they found much farther north than in many previous years. And these are just a few scenes from the harvest.
How much daylight did they have at that time of year?
It was reasonable, you know, 6 or 7 hours. They even that far north, it wasn't too terrible. 5 or 6 hours. Had some good weather, flashes of good weather, but mostly weather more like this. Anyhow, the crab was brought to the port of St. Paul in the Pribilofs, where it was offloaded for processing. This is an island sort of in the middle of the Bering Sea. And this year, that port is entirely, that processing plant is entirely shut down this winter because there was no crab harvest of snow crab. So just to reorient you again, there's Bristol Bay. In the summer, Lauren and I went back to Alaska to look at sort of an opposite, another side of this warming trend, which had been this incredible series of big year runs for sockeye salmon, or red salmon, that returned to Bristol Bay. The 2022 record, it was smashed the previous record harvest that was formed only 1 year earlier. And this is from the spawning grounds as these fish were moving in to areas where they would spawn and create the next generation. And the abundance of fish was such that the brown bears, they had really easy pickings. And this particular bear that we came upon, he basically sucked out the eggs of a female, just the eggs, because that was the tastiest part, and threw it down, still squirming on the ground. They basically high grade when it's that abundant. And To join in this harvest, there's a fleet of some 1,500 gill netters that they converged in Bristol Bay. These are boats up there. They can be, by regulation, more than 32 feet in length. This is how fish are caught. They are caught by the gills. These are gill nets. And the catch is regulated by the State Department of Fish and Game in Alaska, which looks to make sure there's enough getting escape up into the rivers for the next generation. And this is a summer harvest, obviously. It peaks traditionally around the 4th of July. And seafood companies, they contracted with a whole armada of vessels ranging from World War II era scows to Bering Sea crab boats to ferry the fish back to plants. The harvest also involves some 960 beach-based crews that stretch set nets into tidal waters. And shown here is Liz Moore. She's one of four, her family has four generations that have fished from this beach near the Naknek community. And with the set netters, they're stringing out their nets from the beach during the high tides and catching the fish there that move along near close to the shore. And they bleed them, they pile up in skiffs, and then they're brought back to the seafood processing plants, which are pretty massive installations that spring to life just for the summer and then shut down. And the seafood companies, they flew in thousands of workers to handle these fish, and they ended up processing enough salmon, 59.5 million of the sockeye, serve up a quarter pound portion to every person in America. Most of it was blast frozen and shipped to market. Some was fresh.
I'm curious where the workers come from.
They come from all over the Ukraine, Africa, Central America. There's a lot of special visas that are gathered. It's a real mix of folks. There's a few of them. The Philippines. So salmon scientists are still unsure just why, near the northern edge of their Pacific realm, these sockeye have thrived so much as their waters warmed. Obviously, sockeye have struggled many other places further south. They are also grappling with another important question: how warm is too warm? At what point might rising water temperatures undermine the sockeye runs? In 2019, there was a sort of little bit of a foreshadowing, a heat wave that took hold in Bristol Bay, raised the temperatures at the mouths of some rivers to the point where thousands of adult sockeye died. It was quite a dramatic sight for those who saw it. Still, that summer, millions more salmon were able to move into the spawning grounds once the weather eased, and there was enough for the next generation. You can see these are pretty remarkable narrow creekways. And so there was plenty that still made it through that year. And these are just a few last salmon I found just totally remarkable, the way they could go through such shallow water. And this is a little better sense of one of the spawning areas where we visited. So with that, I'm going to end this display, and I think we're done there. And let's see, I want to go to escape, so bear with me. And we want to get rid of this. So let's see where we go here. Sorry. Apologize here. I think I did the wrong thing.
I do see Zoom in the corner there.
Yeah, we got to get to it. Let's see.
You can use the mouse. It acts as a mouse.
All right, I'm sorry. Where is the Zoom?
Down at the bottom.
There we go. Okay, here we go. Full screen. Hello? Can everybody hear me? Okay, great. Okay. Well, I'm going to try to see if I can't put everybody on a fuller screen. Let's see. Gallery?
Full screen.
There we go. Okay. Well, thank you for being here, everybody. We're going to kick this off now. Jamie Gowan is first. She's seen here. She is executive director for Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers, a nonprofit trade association advocating for crab harvesters. She was raised in Florida. Her career, early on, she traveled the world on oceanographic vessels, and she basically ran scientific equipment on the vessels. She spent 15 years at the National Marine Fisheries Service before joining the Bering Sea Crabbers in 2018, when harvests were still relatively strong. Serena Fitka is here with us. Can you hear us, Serena? Okay. And she and her family have a strong connection to the Yukon River. She's executive director of the Yukon Fisheries Drainage Association, a nonprofit of subsistence and commercial fishers and traditional cultures within the Yukon River drainages. These are the areas that depend heavily on Chinook and Chum, where the harvests have really not happened in recent years. She grew up in St. Mary's. She's married to Chris Fitka of Marshall, and together they have three children and currently live in Valdez, Alaska. And then we have Daniel Schindler, who's a University of Washington professor. He's the principal investigator for the Alaska Salmon Program. That means he spends his summers studying sockeye in the Wood River drainage of Bristol Bay, and he looks at how the physical and biological complexities of these watersheds affect the resilience of these salmon. Now, if everybody could be maybe off mute so you can talk and everything, I think I'm going to send the first question to Jamie. From your perspective, what are the main theories that federal fishery scientists have for the reason that the marine heat wave that hit in the Bering Sea had such a huge impact on the snow crab populations off Alaska? And what about king crab? What appears to be the reason for their long-term decline? And I also want to just throw in, at what point could overharvests or other impacts have played a role?
Thanks for the question, Hal. Thanks for having me. This is a great symposium, and just looking at this boom and bust cycle and the effects of climate change that's having on fisheries, and particularly in the Bering Sea, which is actually part of the Arctic, where we're seeing some more extreme changes happening, and they're happening more frequently. I'll start with snow crab, and you covered quite a bit of it in your intro, so I'll keep it brief. But for our snow crab stock, several factors are affecting that stock, and what we saw was a dramatic collapse in the fishery that we think was largely induced by warming waters and a lack of sea ice, so the effects of climate change played a large role. The interesting piece that it was paired with record numbers of snow crab in 2018, so we had a lot of little snow crab out there, historic highs. But when you have that many crab out there in these warm conditions and a lack of sea ice, we think that what happened is there were too many crab out there and they had a higher metabolism because the waters were warm and there wasn't enough food. So they think starvation was a large role in the die-off. And then with the lack of sea ice from a cold pool, which is waters that are less than 2 degrees Celsius, is what we call the cold pool. The cold pool keeps a thermal barrier between cod and snow crab. And when that receded in 2018 and 19, there wasn't much cold pool keeping those stocks separate, and we think a lot of the cod were eating the crab. So predation was a large factor. Another factor is disease. We've been seeing some increased disease rates in snow crab, which scientists are looking further into. And finally, another stressor on the stock is fishing impacts. We don't think that's the driver of the decline in snow crab, but we think that the fishing impacts, particularly bycatch from other fisheries, could be impeding the recovery of the stock. And you touched on this a little bit in your intro too, and having that responsibility to share the burden of conservation among all fishing sectors that are impacting a stock limits at low levels. I'll turn quickly to red crab. That's a little different story because it wasn't a dramatic decline like we saw with snow crab. For red king crab in Bristol Bay, it's been taking a slow downward decline for over a decade now. So we don't think that climate is a large driver in that. We do see recruitment bottlenecks happening, and we're not clear on why there is a recruitment bottleneck with red king crab, so that needs a little more work. But again, like snow crab, we're concerned over fishing impacts on red king crab, largely by catch from other fisheries, and largely when the stock is vulnerable. At certain times of year, the crab molt and mate. When they're molting, they get very soft shell, almost like a gel texture, and it takes them up to 3 months for their shell to harden. In other countries, they don't allow fishing when the stock is in that condition. And in the United States and Alaska, we allow other fisheries to continue fishing in that soft shell state, particularly trawl fisheries, both bottom trawl and pelagic trawl, which is often on the bottom, are fishing on the crab when they're in that vulnerable state. We think it has a very high mortality rate. You asked if overharvest could be playing a role. I don't think overharvest in the directed fishery is playing a role because it's jointly managed between federal and state under very strict management with monitoring and enforcement of that. So I don't think that would be a key factor in these declines. And in the case of snow crab, there's actually a theory that we under-harvested the stock back in 2018 when there were so many crab out there. But the tricky part with that is they were crab that were under a legal size. So they were immature crab, so it wouldn't have made sense to harvest harder on those crab when the population was so high.
Thank you. And we're going to turn now to Serena. And I want to emphasize again that as further to the north, in the Yukon and Kuskokwim, drainage is hugely important. Rivers for subsistence and native tribes in Alaska. Chum and Chinook are the key forms of salmon, and those have been in serious decline. So I wanted to ask you, Serena, how has both this really longer-term decline in Chinook salmon, which some people know as king salmon, it's the largest of the five species, and the more recent collapse of chum, how's that impacted the villages in your region and their subsistence harvest and commercial harvest? What have you seen over the last couple of years?
First of all, thank you for having me. And before I answer your question, I'd just like to give a little context about rural Alaska. The Yukon River drainage is quite large. It's about 2,000 miles long and covers an area of 30,000 square miles, which is equivalent to, it's about 25% bigger than the state of Texas. So it's a very huge drainage. And most of the communities along the Yukon River are rural, which means that we, the only way to get in and out of those communities is by commercial airlines. And those aircrafts are a lot smaller than the regular airlines or airplanes that people commute with in the lower 48, as well as a 207, which is about six passengers per aircraft. And a lot of communities, they get their goods either flown in by cargo or barged in during the summer. So that's it contributes to the high cost of living in the rural communities. For example, a dozen eggs in the lower Yukon River cost about $8 a dozen. Gasoline in the upper parts of Yukon, someone just told me it's about $10 a gallon. And just airfare itself is quite large, just to get from Koglik, which is on the coast at the mouth of the Yukon River, and get to Anchorage, where a lot of people travel for medical needs, is $1,300 round trip.
Wow.
So when you're talking about the high cost of living, it really impacts our subsistence ability. Mostly when our animals and our fish are in decline. Many people still practice their traditional cultures, and it's our food, the land, and our animals on right outside our door. That's our grocery store.
Last summer, what on the Yukon, were any subsistence or commercial, what was able to happen compared to what would have happened in a normal year, which I know there's been a while since a normal year?
Yeah, so it's just getting to that. I mean, for the last 3 years, people on the Yukon River haven't been able to harvest Chinook or Chum salmon, which impacted them greatly, both financially and culturally, because the way we harvest our food, there's a very cultural attachment to that. So over the years, since 1990, since the Chinook salmon have been collapsing, the reliance on Chum salmon have increased. And so now that the Chum salmon have declined, we have no other salmon to rely on, mostly in the upper regions of the Yukon River.
Thank you. Would you just give us a brief update about what you just heard about the forecast for next year? She's just from a conference where they're looking at this upcoming summer and what there might be in terms of fisheries.
Yes, so our yearly preseason meeting just happened for the Yukon River. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game recently put out their outlook for 2023, and they are stating that it will be just the same or worse than previous season. So there will be no subsistence or commercial harvest for 2023. Oh,
thank you. I'd like to bring Daniel into the conversation. He's been pretty patient here. He's a patient guy. He can walk for miles along a river or a creek in the Wood River drainage, assessing just how many salmon are in there and looking back on maybe 20, how many years of experience to compare notes. But anyhow, Daniel, I wonder if we could start out with, because at this conference we've heard so much about the struggles of sockeye salmon, just 5 in the Columbia River Basin, and some of the issues with the Snake River dams. Okay, aside from the lack of dams, that's pretty obvious, what factors are contributing to the sockeye's success in the northern reaches of their realm? You know, what's happening there?
Yeah, and so, I think it's worth noting that, you know, at a global scale, western, southwestern Alaska is really the mecca for sockeye salmon. Sort of the perfect positive storm for the geologic features that were really produced from the last glaciation. So the area of the region is covered in big lakes. And then the rivers are short and pretty flat. So the fish have, they spawn up in the watersheds of those lakes, and then they have migrations to the ocean that are probably less than 100 miles long in all cases. And then they dump into an ocean that's relatively cold and extremely productive. So if you look at where have all the sockeye been produced at the North Pacific scale over the last few centuries, most of them came out of Bristol Bay. So it has a long geologic and human history associated with producing lots of fish. In the last, since the mid-1970s, the productivity of Bristol Bay's sockeye ecosystems has continued to increase. And we think that's a positive response to climate warming. So unlike the Chum and the Chinook salmon that Serena just talked about for the Yukon and the Kuskokwim River to the north, sockeye seem to be benefiting from warming that's both increased how productive the lakes are, but also that nearshore ocean that the smolts of sockeye swim into when they head for the ocean.
Obviously, and I know I've asked you this question before, probably too many times, but since the forecast, as we look ahead, is for increased warming, not in a straight line, but over the decades, we see temperatures going up. Do you have any, if you could just weigh in again on whether there's a tipping point and where that tipping point might be, and even with the great adaptability of the sockeye, if at some point, hey, this is too warm.
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer is there has to be a tipping point. And maybe we've seen that, the beginning of that with crab, like Jamie talked about, or with Chum and Chinook, like Serena talked about. For sockeye, you know, for rivers that drain to the Gulf of Alaska, which is south of Bristol Bay, now this last marine heat wave may have pushed the global, or sorry, the coastal ocean into two warm states. So that the smolts had pretty low survival from those rivers. You know, Bristol Bay fish dump into the Eastern Bering Sea, which is 2 to 3 degrees Celsius colder than the Gulf, and that still seems to be in the sweet spot. Our long-term records going back to the 1940s in Bristol Bay rivers and lakes shows that there's a lot of room for additional warming in the lakes and rivers before we reach a tipping point for sockeye. So, you know, about all we can really say is that tipping point for sockeye probably is going to play out in the coastal ocean, and it's probably 2 or 3 degrees warmer than it has been recently. And that would be a comparison to the Gulf of Alaska. So I think overall, Bristol Bay sockeye are still a good bet for producing lots of fish moving into a warmer climate-altered future.
I'd like to turn it back to Jamie and look at, and I just wanted to note, even as we look at snow crab, if we look at them globally, in Canada, in the Northeast Atlantic, where they did not have the same type of warming patterns, there's like a ton of snow crab. They're having a huge harvest of snow crab. And, you know, if you go to your grocery stores, you will see snow crab. And the price might actually be not bad. And that reflects the fact that so many of these Canadian snow crab, which didn't have the same type of heat wave, are pouring into our markets, which I know must be a little bit frustrating for Alaska crabbers to see so much of that product, but it certainly is around. I wanted, Jamie, if you could give us a better sense about what type of measures at this point in terms of conservation measures or research needs to be done to help bring back the crab stocks or protect what's left. And how long are we looking at until one might think about having the snow crab harvest and the king crab harvest resume?
Those are the million-dollar questions there, Hal. Thanks for those. You mentioned the Canadian stocks. We're looking very closely at what's happening in Canada and trying to learn from how they manage their fisheries and what's happening with their ocean conditions to compare between what we're experiencing here in Alaska to better understand the differences. You noted their waters haven't warmed the way that they did in the Bering Sea. That's one factor. The other factor is that they implement management measures to protect their crab when they're in that soft shell state. So they don't allow trawling on molting and mating crab. That's one key difference in the management styles in the two areas that we're looking at more closely. As far as management measures and what can be done to help these stocks bounce back, I think generally it revolves around moving fisheries in time and space to protect those molting and mating crabs. So, you know, we're not saying any other sector should be shut down, but we may need to move in time and space on how we harvest to address these changing distributions of different species as climate changes and oceans warm, and to protect those vulnerable life stages like molting and mating crab, and also to protect the habitat that they rely on. One of the other areas we think that could be done is to create better incentives to reduce bycatch across all sectors. in the Bering Sea. As far as when they might come back, that's the million-dollar question. We hope we may have a small red king crab harvest this fall. We've been closed for 2 years now. 25 years ago, red king crab was also closed for 2 years in a row, and then it opened back up again. We're hoping that same pattern holds true. For snow crab, the federal managers just went through a rebuilding plan process, and they were warning us that it may be 6 years before that stock bounces back. That's really hard for my fleet to digest because that's our bread and butter moneymaker fishery. That fishery alone is worth about $200 million ex vessel value a year. So if we don't have that fishery for 6 years or so, we are gonna lose our small second, third generation family fishing businesses. We have roughly 60 vessels on the fishery. I already have vessels that have been sold because of the closures these last 2 years, and people are selling their homes. So it's only going to get worse the longer these closures last.
Thank you. And Serena, I know that among the tribal community, there is great concern about the word bycatch, which is, you know, the accidental or incidental harvest of a species by someone pursuing another type of fish. There's also what we call interceptions, where there are fishermen in the Alaska Peninsula who target salmon, some of the salmon they catch would have eventually come back to Western Alaska to spawn, and that's a state-managed harvest. Meanwhile, at a federally managed level, pollock fleets are scooping up some chum salmon as they catch these pollock that end up in fish burgers and everything. Scientists have said it's a relatively small amount that would have returned to Western Alaska, but I know it's a huge concern to your people. So I hope you could talk a little bit about what you've been involved in terms of bycatch, and also any frustrations that you feel about the tribal voices at helping to manage the fisheries at a state and federal level, and whether you feel like there needs to be a greater voice. It seems like that issue is boiling up as well.
Yes, so I served on the salmon bycatch committee that the council formed recently. And we just provided recommendations to the AP for
which is the review. Advisory panel.
Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. And there was a lot of testimony from different tribal organizations, people from rural communities, really telling their story of how the lack of salmon had impacted their lives, and it feels, a lot of people feel that they haven't made a dent in any movement for bycatch numbers or enforcement or any kind of reduction in bycatch. It's really concerning because at this point along the Yukon River, We're talking about every salmon matters right now. For last year, the Eagle Sonar, which is at the border of Alaska and Canada, because we do have treaty obligations with Canada, we need to get so much fish across the border for them to harvest and for them to spawn. And last year, only 12,000 Chinook salmon passed the sonar. Where we used to have, at least 300, 400, 500,000 Chinook salmon pass. And with the chum salmon, it's just as low. We used to have, in Pilot Station, the Lower River, we used to have 1.6 million chum salmon pass the sonar, and last year, over 400,000 chum salmon passed the sonar. So it's a really big concern. Mostly in our indigenous culture, where we don't waste any parts of our fish. Everything is utilized. from on that silo we harvest. So to hear bycatch where they just throw the fish overboard or burn it up and toss back into the ocean is very disheartening, very disrespectful to the salmon and to the people who depend on it for food. And we can't even throw our nets in the water.
Daniel, I know you've been very outspoken a bit on the questions of the interceptions of the Chum and Chinook that would be going back to Western Alaska by some of the fleets on the Alaska Peninsula, and you testified in at the state level for stricter measures. Do you want to comment briefly on that?
Sure. I mean, it's a long and complex story, but in essence, I think the place to start is that, you know, Alaska has a constitution and has what we call a sustainable salmon policy that most parts of the world are totally envious of. It's based on principles that make sense for conserving fish and for providing opportunity for subsistence harvest. And what it does is it prioritizes fish for the ecosystem first, and then if there are sufficient fish to satisfy the watershed needs for spawning fish, the next priority is for subsistence harvest. And it's not just a little bit of subsistence harvest, it's enough. It's the amount needed for subsistence livelihoods. So it's not just an opportunity to go out and catch a couple of fish, it's the opportunity to go out and catch enough fish to feed your family, like what Serena's been telling us about. And the sustainable salmon policy then says if those two priorities are met, you can open it up for other take, including commercial and sport harvest. And, you know, the issue with some of the current other state managed fisheries and some of the federal fisheries is there is still commercial harvest of some of these fish that would otherwise make it back to watersheds to contribute to the spawning populations. In recent years, the runs are so depressed that I don't think that had you not had those interceptions that there would have been much subsistence harvest, because the runs are so low right now. But at least those fish would have made it back to contribute to spawning populations and allowed a faster recovery once the ocean conditions improve, which I think they will at some point. So, you know, that's the paradox here, I think, is that Alaska has an incredible constitution that emphasizes the sustainability, and it has a sustainable salmon policy, which is really includes the, you know, the best principles we have for sustaining salmon populations into the future.
I think just to clarify for people, there are basically two ways that harvest rules get made in the waters that impact Alaska. One is at the state level, there's something called the Board of Fish, and these are appointed by the governor, and they basically make rules that regulate the harvest. So there was a big battle at the Board of Fish meeting earlier this year over how many fish and how long people should be able to fish who were intercepting some of the Western Alaska salmon in what's the False Pass area, Area M on the Alaska Peninsula. Likewise, the council that Serena mentioned, the Federal Fishery Council, it's made up of industry, state officials, a few federal officials. They're appointed by governors and such. And so they all have, well, particularly industry people, vested interests, but they make a lot of harvest rules that are then passed on to the federal government, the National Marine Fisheries Service, to finalize. So it can be a very long, complicated process. And there's a lot of there's a lot of room for testimony, but sometimes decision-making like this question of putting a cap or a limit on how many chum salmon could be caught by the trawlers, that process is expected to take, 2 years or more to actually reach some sort of rule that might actually take effect. So these battles, they stretch on for years, and sometimes the resources, meanwhile, are in the balance. So it's a complicated process. I would like to open it up now for questions. That's great that we have a bunch. I think I'll send you a mic so that you'll speak into a mic, if that's okay. Let me give you first.
Thank you. Then you can pass. Okay, sounds great. Thank you for being here. This question is for Serena. I wanted to ask more. I know that...
Could you identify yourself? I should have said that journalists and SEJ members are supposed to have priority for asking questions, and people are supposed to identify themselves.
Yes.
So apologize.
So this is Katie Delk. I'm from Florida, like Jamie, and I report for TC Palm, which I'm primarily looking at the Indian River Lagoon. So I want to ask Serena more. I'm curious, earlier when you mentioned using all the parts of the salmon, I just was curious. I read at one point that the Salmon River people and indigenous peoples on the Oregon coast would collect the salmon bones and use them like as compost on the shores. And I was wondering if you use similar practices and if you could talk more about conserving all the parts and conservation and yes. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the question. We utilize all the fish we boil, the salmon head, so boil, there's a lot of meat in there. So we eat that, the tail. When we process our salmon for dry fish or strips, usually known as smoked salmon, even using the backbone, either save that for human consumption or we feed it to our sled dogs. Every part's used for our traditional practices. Any scraps or leftovers of the salmon, we're taught to bury them in the ground. It's a way of giving back and completing the circle of life, that what we take goes back to the earth.
Hi, my name is Marlo Starling. I'm a freelance reporter based in New York, also from Florida. I listening to all of you talk about all of this, the stuff that you're talking about is remarkably similar to some of the fisheries that we've seen in Florida, actually, which is kind of strange to recognize, but notably being the stone crab fishery in South Florida and the northward migration of snook to the Gulf of Mexico because of warming waters. So I just find that parallel really interesting, and it makes me think about the fact that, you know, we are in the middle of climate change and we don't expect things to change, and don't expect that warming to reverse. And so, you know, we're seeing these permanent rain shifts. And I'm curious to know kind of what you all would say the takeaway is from what we're witnessing right now, clearly in several places, more places than just the Bering Sea, you know, whether it's a matter of adapting to, you know, having industries adapt to these changes, or if it's really a matter of continuing to adapt the management plans to what we're seeing, or maybe it's a mix of both. And if it's the latter, I mean, is there major pushback from industries in Alaska, from commercial, you know, fisher people, when those management plans get changed?
Jamie, do you want to weigh in first, and then anyone can jump in?
Yeah, happy to, Marla. That's a great question and good observation, and I think the answer is both. We need to be adapting our current fishery management plans for the fisheries, but we also need to be recognizing that stocks are shifting. So we need to change our management practices at an ecosystem level. And I think it's gonna require government agencies and management systems to be more flexible and responsive. And that is not embedded in our US fisheries management system. These are very, for lack of a better word, lethargic systems that often take years for management changes to be made. As Serena was noting, So I think building more responsive U.S. management, both state level and the federal level, I think people are going to have to adapt. The stocks are shifting, and that may change who's responsible, particularly at state levels. I know on the East Coast, for who's managing the fishery, there's going to have to be changes there. And by the fishermen themselves, something in our fleet of crabbers that we're looking at, because we are in the middle of a crisis right now. And what we realize is that you need to be diversified to survive. Otherwise, we're going to lose our family and businesses and small independent harvesters. So how do we create more flexibility in U.S. fisheries to move between crab and salmon and cod? Right now, we have limited entry programs around the country, and there isn't that flexibility to move between fisheries. But as climate is causing some stocks to collapse and others to boom, how do we create some more flexibility in our management system?
Serena, I'm just going to see, did you want to jump in on that?
Yes, I think the first thing that comes to mind is adapting to our changes. And the people of the Connie River, you know, they had to do that very quickly by harvesting other salmon or other species of fish that they don't usually harvest during the summer season. So it was a very hard transition, but adapting comes to mind. And along with management, we all of us have to contribute. It feels like the Yukon River right now is the people of the Yukon are pretty much bearing the brunt of conservation, while other sectors are not contributing. And so it's like my analogy is, in order to fill your berry bucket, you know, you can't have 10 hands taking berries out of your bucket, otherwise you're not going to fill it. So it's, you know, we have to break down those silos and really try to work together and really have conservation across the board in management.
Thank you. Next question here.
Hello, can you guys hear me? So my name is Alex Hager. I currently am a reporter for KUNC Public Radio in Colorado, but this is an issue that's very near and dear to my heart because in the summer of 2019, I was a fish reporter at KDLG in Dillingham and hosted the Bristol Bay Fish Report 7 nights a week.
Oh, so, wow.
And I think I actually interviewed Daniel for a story on salmon otoliths. And this is a question for Daniel. You know, you said that there's a lot of room for warming in those Bristol Bay streams and lakes before we reach a breaking point, but I was wondering if you could elaborate a little on how much room, you know, if it's sustainable to keep seeing solid fish returns even through warming. You know, I mean, I'm kind of curious how quickly that might fall off. And then also the summer of 2019, while I was up there, a lot of the conservation energy and a lot of the things that you know, commercial fishermen were rallying around were about efforts to prevent the development of pebble mine. And now that I understand that's not really front of mind for folks up in that neck of the woods anymore, if there have been any other kind of big prominent issues that the conservation community up there has taken up.
Yeah, update us on pebble and other threats as part of that response, Daniel.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I recognize your voice. I don't know if we ever met in person, but I recognize your radio voice, so that's good. Yeah, the question about how much room is there for warming in Bristol Bay, you know, I think you need to think about it as the coupled system between the physical environment and the fish. And the physical environment, of course, will continue to warm as climate warms, but the fish have evolutionary potential to change things like their migration timing and their maturation schedules, so the timing of various life history events. You know, in response to the previous question, it's worth keeping in mind that, you know, the species of fish that we're all talking about today have existed on Earth for literally millions of years. And they haven't existed on Earth for millions of years by doing the same thing every year. They have evolutionary capacity to change their distributions, to change their behavior, the migration timings, and these sort of things. So if we look to the future and ask, well, how much capacity is there to deal with new climate change, the answer has to be give those fish a chance.
and give that give the fish a chance, or the crabs a chance, or whatever your interest in species is, means keep the habitat intact, lay off on the fishing pressure when you need to, like what we're seeing right now in the Yukon River and the Kuskokwim River on chum salmon and Chinook salmon. And then there's a lot of capacity for things like salmon to work their way through it. So in Bristol Bay, because, you know, unlike the Snake River going to Idaho, which is literally thousands of kilometers long and has a long migration path for salmon trying to make it up there, like I said earlier, the Bristol Bay rivers are relatively short, and the lakes they drain are huge lakes that are going to remain cool at depth, even with a lot of climate warming. So, yeah, I think that answers the first part of your question. The second part of your question, and related to Hal's comment, is, yeah, pebble mining was something that has been on the minds of conservation and fishing and subsistence communities of Bristol Bay for almost 20 years now. And the reason it was, there's really two reasons why it was a huge threat. One is that mine itself was going to be a very dirty mine. It was huge, would have been one of the largest, if not the largest, open pit mines in North America. And it was basically a sulfur mine. You know, they were trying to get copper and gold out of it, but most of what was going to be produced was sulfur, which is going to produce acid mine drainage. So the mine itself had a bunch of direct threats associated with it, mainly the storing tailings on site. But the more insidious threat was that the infrastructure needed to open up Pebble Mine would basically open the door for a whole bunch of other mines in the region. Now, Serena talked about how vast and remote these ecosystems are. It's really hard to imagine that unless you go see them for yourself. There aren't roads to all these places, and there aren't power lines to places where they want to take minerals out of the ground. So the infrastructure is a key limitation. And something like Pebble would have really opened up the infrastructure needed to develop other deposits. So right now, to your question, Hal, what are the new issues on the conservation front? You know, some of the bycatch issues and some of the issues with chum and chinook are certainly front and center, that's what Rita talked about, but there's still ongoing activity to try to protect the habitat. Again, whether you're a sport fisher, someone from a tribal community who subsistence fishes, or a commercial fisher up there, you recognize that habitat, clean, healthy habitat, is what makes all these animals so productive and allows them to be harvested at rates that generate a lot of money and support cultures. So the ongoing battle to protect habitat before it's screwed up, like we've done in the lower 48, is still front and center in the conservation community. And that pressure cannot go away because it's a slippery slope towards developing habitat for things like mines and cities and you name it. It's hard to get back once it's been developed.
But the EPA has finalized a rule that would basically make it pretty difficult. It is going to face a legal challenge in court, almost assuredly, from pebble developers, but it would preclude the development, although there are some other areas where there might be potential development, and there's ongoing efforts to sort of acquire easements and such.
Well, it's more than that, actually, Hal. I mean, there's a move afoot to try to get permanent protection for most of the Bristol Bay watershed, because there are dozens of big claims that are staked and are, you know, are at risk of being developed beyond Pebble. So, yeah, there's lots to do there.
Well, we have a few more questions, so our next question.
Hi, my name is Fanny Yin. I'm a freelance reporter. I also do communications for the North American Marine Alliance. So I've spoken with you before, Jamie. My question's about the trawler bycatch. I know that tribal and fishing communities have long been concerned about the amount of bycatch from the trawl fleet. And yet the, you know, pollock is considered a sustainable fishery, and it's certified as sustainable by the MSC, and it's sold as sustainable in everything from filet-o-fish at McDonald's to imitation crab meat. So my understanding is that part of the reason is because it's just such a massive fishery. It's one of the biggest fisheries in the world. So when you dilute the impacts over such a massive amount of harvest, it seems like the impacts are very small. But that issue of the scale seems like it's not really talked about enough, or there's not enough public understanding around that. So I guess for everyone, but particularly Serena, I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about whether you find that sustainability certification misleading. And I also wanted to separately ask if you are involved in the fight against the Donlin gold mine, if you could talk a little bit about that as well. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. For Donlin gold, when I worked for our tribe, back in the early 2000s, it was very hard to receive information. Like I said, in the rural communities, internet's very very difficult, and only the people have really bad connections. So it was there was really hard to get public comments or have public meetings where there's a lot of participation for Donlin gold. I personally felt that just the awareness of Donlin gold is not present in the communities, and so every time I seen a meeting happen was not by advertisement, it was just by passing by a door at a big conference. And I would immediately go in and make myself available to provide testimony for our communities in our region. And it's something that I've voiced to them numerous times, that they need to make sure that that when they do have meetings, that they need to be reaching out to the communities and to the tribal leaders. So there's still presence of people out there that are very active in voicing their concerns about Donlin gold. But I myself have shifted from my region to more specifically fisheries for the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association. But we still try to maintain our voice and make our voices heard. That we do not support development that will affect our salmon.
Did you want to speak briefly to the pollock and the sustainability? There's a sustainability level label that she was asking about. How you feel about that?
I feel that. I have mixed feelings, and I can't really speak for the whole Yukon River Drainage on how they feel about that, because we do represent communities as well on the coast for that are involved with the CDQ program, and so it's they've voiced that they want their salmon is priority over the pollock industry. But at the same time, I feel like I'm not too familiar with the sustainability.
One complexity in the whole bycatch mm-hmm. issue with this chum salmon is that most of the chum salmon that the pollock fleet catches, believe it or not, this is through genetic testing by National Marine Fisheries Service, are hatchery chum that come from Russia and Japan, and migrate over to the area where the pollock fleets are trawling. And so they're actually removing more hatchery fish from Asia, but about, depending on the year, 10 to 20% are Western Alaska chum that, recent years have been desperately needed to return to that area. So that's just another wrinkle. It's pretty well documented through a decade of genetic testing. So I don't mean to waylay that, and I know we have other questions. Just wanted to add that.
And Hal, I would love to jump in on public sustainability.
Oh, sure.
Just from a crab perspective, we do have concerns, for the pollock fishery itself and its sustainability. You know, the pollock resource seems very healthy, and they fish with pelagic trawl that's thought to be, in the midwater column. And in their sustainability documents, it says that it's in the midwater column, but we have data now showing that that gear is actually on the bottom between 40 and 100% of the time. So the concern there for crab and crab habitat is the impacts that gear is having on habitat and the crab themselves, particularly for unaccounted for bycatch. So that's bycatch where a trawl, like a pollock trawl or a bottom trawl, is running over crab and potentially causing some mortality, but it is not counted as bycatch because it doesn't make it into the cod end to be observed up on deck of the vessel. And right now, there's no estimate. It's estimated as a zero, and we know that impact is not zero. It's potentially very significant for crab as a benthic species and for the habitat.
Yeah, thanks for jumping in on that. That's a point, and we had reported that in our story that there is quite a bit more documentation that these nets basically do hit the bottom, and they're very big. They're bigger than some of the other trawl nets, so they can impact the bottom and crab that are down there. You've been waiting patiently, so let me let you ask your question.
Hi, my name is Penny Overton. I'm a reporter with the Portland Press Herald in Maine. So Jimmy, don't go anywhere because I have a crustacean question for you. It's bycatch in the other sense, though, kind of flipping it. I'm wondering if you're under any pressure to have a fleet switch from fixed gear to ropeless to avoid bycatch for whales or tortoises. And then also, this is maybe simplistic, but I'm just wondering how you know that the crab population is in decline and that they're not just settling in colder, deeper waters. That's something that we thought Maine for about 10 years, and then we found them out further in the Gulf of Maine, which is also warming really fast. So surprise, we're actually still in a boom. I mean, it's going to go bust, but I'm just wondering if, like, how you know and how you're able to convince your fleet that the scientists actually know that. So if you don't mind, that's a lot of questions, but if you want to tackle any of those, that'd be great.
Good question.
Yeah, these are great questions, and I will say there are over 300 fishermen in my membership, and I can tell you they don't all believe the science and that the crab are in decline. We have to trust that we have good data and that NOAA Fisheries does an annual trawl survey for all the fish stocks in the Bering Sea, and it's got, we've got decades of data, so we know the trends, and we know the trend of crabs down. But your observation in Maine is similar to what some of my fishermen say. They're convinced that snow crab in particular went to deeper waters. What we hear from the scientists, though, is there's not enough real estate to house the 10 plus billion crab that were out there. So there wasn't enough real estate to house them, but some of them may have gone to deeper waters that isn't surveyed. So that is one theory.
Russian waters.
Yeah, or Russian waters, right. I have some fishermen that also say that we are in record tides right now. So extreme tides, and crab bury down in the mud when they're in these extreme tides. So they're concerned that the trawl may have missed them because they had buried down in the mud when they came through. So there is a variety of opinions there of what happened. But we do have that standard summer trawl survey that shows that the trend has been down. Your other question about whales and ropeless gear is a good one. I was on the phone with Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch program today about that. We are watching it closely. Our pots that we fish with are much bigger than other parts of the country, such as New England or Dungeness crab off the West Coast. They're large 7-foot by 7-foot pots that weigh about 800 pounds. So ropeless gear, I think it would be difficult to implement with the style of pots that we have. Knock on wood, we have not had whale interactions. There's been one case of a bowhead back in 2016. That's it. The whales don't tend to be in the area when we're fishing, but it's something that we're watching very closely and recognize that we may have to adapt and change gear and how we fish if it becomes an issue.
We have another question and we're running short on time, so I want to make sure you get your chance.
Hey, I'm Michael Warren. I'm with NJ Spotlight News in New Jersey. I have two questions that I guess are going to be mostly for Jamie, and they're a little disparate. But first, I'm curious, you know, when you talk to your or people in your fleet who might be looking to transition to targeting different species, you know, what that looks like, what it entails for a fisherman to actually change from, I don't know, crabbing to going for cod or something. And then the other question I have is, Hal kind of alluded to it, but, you know, what role, particularly with you guys' situation on the Bering, do the Russians play in this? I mean, like, are there regulators on the same page with the American thinking? Is there a chance that there's heavier or lighter pressure on the crab from their side?
Yeah, thanks for those great questions. I'll start with the Russian one. We do have some information coming out of Russia on snow crab, and what it looks like is their vessels have been fishing closer to the U.S.-Russia border. At the same time, our vessels were fishing closer to the U.S.-Russia border. So the scientists think the snow crab population that's transboundary there could be condensing, so that both sides may be seeing similar decline in the population. Since then, the war with Ukraine has happened and communications have been cut off, so there isn't as much happening right now. In fact, there used to be a joint fisheries advisory body, but that was just recently dissolved by the Department of State, unfortunately. So don't have much more information there on the Russian side. As far as how to diversify, that's been part of our crisis management plan here. I don't have good answers now. I know recently the council took action to lock down the Greenland turbot fishery. So some of my guys thought that might be an opportunity for something to move into, but the council at this last meeting just locked us out of moving into that fishery. Some boats are naturally diversified. They fish with pot gear, so they can fish both Pacific cod with pot gear or crab with pot gear. But my boats that do fish for Pacific cod, that helps them weather this downturn in crab, but it's not the moneymaker that crab is. So long term, they may not be able to stay financially viable on just cod. They also tender, what's called tendering for salmon in the summer, where they act as a mothership, bringing the salmon on from the smaller gillnet vessels. So that also helps them have some diversity, but again, it's not the moneymaker that crab is. So can't sustain them long term. So I'm talking with leadership at NOAA Fisheries to explore, like, how can we help fleets become more flexible and move between fisheries? So it's a big question mark right now.
We're just running short on time. I wondered if Daniel or Serena or Jamie, anybody has some last thoughts or remarks? You had a very attentive audience here. And I really appreciate everyone's time, but just wanted to ask if there are any last remarks or whatever, because we're going to have to wrap it up.
I always have more to say, Hal. I mean, I guess my parting comment would be, if there's a lesson to be had from this case study and Alaska fisheries in general, the reality is climate change is pushing us into a place we haven't been before. And our ability to predict what it's going to look like and what species will be abundant and where it'll be accessible to harvest, etc., is our ability to predict those things is really poor. So my feeling is, if we want to keep fisheries productive and supporting economies and livelihoods, we need to protect the habitat and enable fisheries that are flexible. And when I say flexible, it's some of the themes that we've heard about from a couple of people today, and that is responsive to short-term indicators of either declines or increases in abundance. So you can turn off the fishing when abundances go down, and you can turn up the fishing when there's good opportunities that arise, because climate change will produce winners and losers. You know, the journalism the media tends to emphasize the losers, but climate change is also producing winners, whether it's Bristol Bay sockeye or the turbot that Jamie just mentioned. So part of the strategy for us as fishing communities and fishing both in the science and in the processing and harvesting sectors is monitor and stay flexible and get ready to deal with surprises, because we're going to see more surprises than we'd like to admit.
Well, thank you. We had, before we visited with you all, we had watched this, we got a sneak preview of an upcoming PBS special on the American buffalo, and talking about the sustainability of both native harvests of the buffalo and then this spectacular implosion of their populations that came when they were exploited. So it was an interesting backdrop to coming into talking about all this. It's going to be a 4-hour special that shows this fall, it sounds like. Anyhow, I want to thank you guys so much for taking the time to do this long distance. I hope it worked. I think it worked really pretty well. Thank you for coming. And I know now that it's 3:30, so whatever's next is supposed to happen. But thank you guys so much.